Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I'm very glad to have this opportunity to talk to you again because I see this hour more and more truly as a privilege. And as time passes, there's so much that deserves to be said that is not getting out to people enough. I think I'm one of the few that says the kind of things that I'm saying. That makes me glad that I'm doing it. I've had to cull some interesting topics down to just a few tonight, but that's all right. And I want to start out with an interview published on a Russian multi-language website called RIA Novosti. And this was brought to my attention by a listener of and a most excellent commenter on several VOR programs, but I always think his best comments are about my program. And he is a German person, and he calls himself a German. Anyway, he recommended an article to me that I found very, very interesting, and it's about the lack of a peace treaty from World War II. The title of it is The Soviet Union's Crucial Role in German Reunification. This is, I think, not Russian propaganda, but could be the way it really is. So I'm going to talk about this a little bit because the lack of a peace treaty for Germany after 50 years after the war is one of the things that really I think is important, and most people have no idea that that's the case. This also involves here the reunification of Germany, of East and West Germany, 20 years ago on October 3rd. And this was an interview with the historian Alexei Finenko, who is the lead researcher at the Russian Academy of Sciences Institute of International Security Studies in Russia, and he said some very interesting things. He was interviewed by someone named Samir Shahbaz. Mr. Finenko said, in the question about the reunification on the anniversary, October 3rd, that when the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, there were two proposed options for reunification. There was the 2+4 scenario and the 4+2 scenario. And the 2+4 was where the two Germanys, East and West, would meet to work out the terms of reunification, and then the four victorious powers would join them later. And in the 4+2, the four powers would work out a plan for reunification, and then they would be joined later by the two Germanys to find out what they had worked out. Now, what's kind of outlandish in the first place is that these four victorious powers are still playing this role in Germany and in their government, in their destiny, and everything they do. They are still in control, the four victorious powers from World War II, including Russia, which used to be the Soviet Union and is now a different country, so to speak, although the same people and landmass. But so this is shocking already, but you know, the thing is, the German government doesn't really complain about this much because they are put in place by these four victorious powers, but basically by the United States, which is really the boss of the four victorious powers. Not so much the boss of Russia, but it has more power than anybody else. So, and they are the ones who are basically occupying Germany today. So the story is, by this Russian, he says that Britain and France were staunch supporters of the 4+2. That is, they wanted the four nations to decide on what could be done with the reunification, and then they would tell the Germany what that was. But he says that it was Russia's Mikhail Gorbachev who supported the 2+4, And he convinced the United States to do so also, and America threw its weight behind that idea and pressured France and Britain to accept it. So the 2+4 went forward, and they came to an agreement, and it is called the Treaty on the Final Settlement with Respect to Germany. It was signed in Moscow on September 12, 1990. This sounds like a peace treaty, doesn't it? Treaty on the Final Settlement with Respect to Germany. But it is not. What this agreement did, it says that it fully restored Germany's sovereignty because the victors renounced all rights to German territories. That's new. I guess they still had a right. They had not given up their right to take over all German territory up until this point. But on the condition that Germany agreed to its internationally recognized borders as they now stand in Europe. However, this Moscow agreement, called the Treaty on the Final Settlement with respect to Germany, is not legally a peace treaty. And this Russian points out that to this day, neither Russia nor any of the others have signed a peace treaty with Germany. The reason it's not a peace treaty is because it has four limitations on Germany's sovereignty that still remain, and it makes those clear. These remain still from the 1952 Bonn Treaty, in which, number one, Germany cannot hold a referendum on military issues. That is, you know, they are not able to raise any military other than that which is approved of by the four powers. And number two, Germany cannot demand a withdrawal of the forces, coalition forces, before a peace treaty had been signed. Well, since there's no peace treaty, it still remains that Germany cannot demand that, say, the U.S. withdraw its forces from their country. And number three, Germany is barred from taking major decisions without prior agreement of the four powers. I find that really vague. They are barred from taking major decisions, whatever, anything major. They have to have the agreement. They have to put that forward to the four powers first and have it approved. And basically, that means United States and probably Russia, because I think that Britain and France pretty much do whatever the United States tells them to do. And number four, they are barred from developing weapons of mass destruction. Therefore, they can't have a nuclear weapon program. Now, the reason that this is kind of a problem is NATO, and I'll get to that in a minute, but this Russian says that Britain and France feared Germany in the early 1990s. Now, this is right after reunification, or right while the time they were trying to have reunification, and right after that. And it's true, we know that Britain and France have always feared Germany. I mean, that's what really caused World War I, what caused World War II, because they, both of them, who had been, well, France had had a glorious past of being the dominant in Europe, and Britain was at the time, and they feared and disliked the fact that Germany had the potential to be such a strong and a leading nation. And so it says that, and they still did in the 1990s. And after Yugoslavia disintegrated in 1991, Paris and London made every effort to persuade the United States President Bill Clinton to retain at all costs the U.S. military presence in Germany in order to continue to exert control on that country's, on Germany's policies. And this is the way it's been going. This is all well documented in this Russian, just points that out. But he then says that in April 2009, the German parliament adopted recommendations drafted by Angela Merkel's cabinet. And what they did was the German parliament proposed that a withdrawal of U.S. tactical weapons from Germany be considered. That is, a withdrawal of the United States and their weapons of mass destruction, which they have in Germany, and also probably their forces. So it says that the obvious conclusion would be that Germany is planning to develop its own defense policy. Well, yes, but they only say that it be considered because, you see, they have no right to to force the United States to do anything because they don't have a final treaty. They're not a sovereign nation. Now, the United States insists that it needs to maintain a common NATO nuclear policy, and therefore it needs to keep its nuclear weapons in Germany, and Germany needs to continue to be defended by NATO, and NATO needs to be continue to be enforced. NATO is a problem. NATO's worthwhileness was ended when the Soviet Union collapsed, but they have found ways and means to keep it going, and now it's kind of a Anglo-American military force that's global, that is continue to be funded by everybody and forced on everyone. So this policy, he says, is aimed at preserving control over Germany. They don't want to let go of that. And I don't believe that there's any intention of ever giving Germany back the sovereignty that they once enjoyed and that every other nation in the world has, except Germany, as far as I know. Because I've said before that I think the rest of Europe and the rest of, the rest of the free world wants to keep Germany as their slave. They're afraid of Germany's leadership, the power the increase that Germany can bring about over the influence over others, and they don't want Germany to be influential. They want to keep Germany working for them. So this Russian says, I can tell you that Germany needs Russia because they know that Russia, of all the World War II winners, would be willing to discuss a peace treaty one of these days. Well, that shows you that nothing is immediately ready to be done. But he says that Russia is more open to sovereignty for Germany. Of course, Russia will want to have their influence there in Germany and want Germany to move toward them. Germany truly is pivotal. As the German wrote on my last week's program page, he quotes Lenin as saying, "Who owns Germany owns Europe." Germany is pivotal. Germany is so powerful, so necessary, so central, and everyone wants to control Germany, and they want to own Germany, and they want to keep Germany functioning in their interests. And this is the state that we're in now. But you all need to know that Germany is not sovereign, and Germany is being treated like, unfairly, you know, being treated like a lesser than being. But unfortunately, the people who govern Germany are puppets put in place by the occupation forces, by the United States and Britain, and they tell the German people that they have everything they need, they have everything they want, and they shouldn't try to push anything because they just might go too far again and bring all kinds of disaster on themselves. So I want to switch now to something very, very interesting to me, and that is the trial of Ursula Haverbeck. We're moving directly into Holocaust revisionism here. You know, the trial of John Demjanjuk is in the news, but the trial of Ursula Haverbeck, which is not as big a trial for sure, and it's not that much at stake, but still, you'll never read about it unless you get something from some of the people who know her and go to these trials and write about them. Like Gunter Deckert went to the Zundel and Rudolph and Stoltz trials, and he made his own report on what took place there. Well, what I have here is a report that was made by someone who attended Ursula's trial, and she is a woman who's been... She's gone to all these trials herself. She's quite well known amongst this group in Germany that supports the revisionists and stands up for the truth about the Holocaust. And anyway, this is kind of humorous. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman, and she wrote a book, and she sent the book out to school children. And this is a few years ago, and now they brought charges against her based on Volks. Verhetzung, which is the people's agitation, agitating the people. You know, Volks is the people, and Verhetzung is the agitation. And this is from paragraph 130, that is that terrible legal ruling that they put in there to bring anybody who does anything that they call agitating the people, or anything of dissent, you know, they can, it's a crime in Germany. So she went to court. Her trial began last Monday, a week ago. And it was a 2-day trial or a 3-day trial. She's 81 years old now. And she has accused of having written a document defaming the Jews and denying the Holocaust. And here's something she did when she was questioned, when she was being questioned by the judge about her citizenship, you know, just a regular question. She answered briskly, Deutsches Reich, and instead of Bundesrepublik, DR or BDR, which is, and Deutsches Reich is the official title of the Third Reich. Lots of people in Germany, because of this peace treaty situation that I just finished talking about, and because that means there is no real constitution set up by the people of Germany, they still have the basic law given to them by the United States, they consider that the government has never changed. There has been no new governing body set up in Germany, and therefore it continues to be the Third Reich. Okay, the prosecution accuses this woman from Westphalia of belittling the mass murder of Jews during National Socialism by using primarily satire. The Jews and the court says that they were described as liars because, she says in the book, the Holocaust does not exist. This is something like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny for grown-ups. So if in Germany, if you say that the Holocaust doesn't exist, then you are accusing the Jews in particular of being liars. You know, the Holocaust belongs, according to the Jews, it's theirs, it's all about them, and anybody who defames it is defaming them. Whereas in reality, whatever happens that is called the Holocaust includes a lot more people than the Jews, but nope, that's the way it is. So she's defaming the Jews, and well, I'm going to tell you now about her book. It is so very interesting. It's 76 pages. She calls it sometimes a booklet, kind of like my short book. And she titled it Amalia Hinterwelder und andere Geschichten. And Amalia Hinterwelder is the name of a woman, but Hinterwelder means from the boondocks. So it's kind of a funny name. It's satire. Amalia from the boondocks. And Und andere Geschichten is something like another history or a different history. Geschichten is something about history. And some of the trial visitors had the book with them, her book. And in the book, Amalia tries to convince her opposite in a fictional dialogue, you know, it's fiction, that no Holocaust occurred and that no Jews were murdered at Auschwitz. And so she sent this book to the schools, and then they stick the judiciary on her. So toward the end of the trial, some of these people, you know, they had brought their book with them. And maybe they had more than one. I can't be sure, but it says one visitor started to distribute the booklet, and the trial prosecutor, Hans Joachim Lutz, reacted right away. This is the prosecutor, remember. He ordered someone to take the personal data of the man and announced, this gives reason for the next trial. So when you attend one of these trials, you have to be very careful because they're looking for any of the supporters if they can get something on them and put them on trial also. As we know, often at times the lawyers for the defendants have been charged and put on trial themselves because of things they've said. So Ms. Haverbeck said that she considered her writing as an artistic contribution. This when she was questioned in court. An artistic contribution that students have the right to learn the pros and cons, and because that's the basis for judgment forming. And so she was contributing to the school's store of literature in when they're teaching these high school students in Germany. But the prosecution brought on a witness, Max Schmidt, who is the chairman of the Bavarian Philological Association, who had warned about this booklet in 2006, and he said one has to evaluate it as an attempt of, quote, right radical rat catchers, unquote, to win young voters shortly before the Bundestag elections or the parliament elections. So she is being accused of some of their hate crimes, but he is in court calling her, as this very dignified, beautiful woman, a right radical rat catcher. Well, now, also, the publisher of the book is a 91-year-old co-defendant. They brought charges against him, too. They only call him G, of Otterbrunn near Munich, and he's also accused of supporting the people agitation crime. And he accepted that he published the book, but he said that he didn't know that it was going to be distributed to students. So, and now, according to the chief of investigation that I suppose testified, he said that Miss Haverbeck was the principal of the Collegium Humanum, yes, a school that she opened and which was closed by the Federal Constitutional Court in 2008. It was a school that represented and distributed revisionism, according to the court. So there were several legal procedures entered against her, and on last Friday she had to appear at another court in Bielefeld where she's accused of slandering libel. Well, this particular trial ended on Wednesday, last Wednesday, October 6th, and Ursula Haverbeck was given a suspended sentence of 6 months, and she must also pay nearly a $1,400 fine. It said dollars in this article, which was a U.S. article, so I guess it's dollars, not euros. Her 91-year-old co-defendant, the publisher, because his name was used on the book, well, naturally, he's a publisher, you know, he was fined more than $800. Now, the judge, Norbert Riedman, said that he doubted Ursula Haverbeck would change her views, but that she had to be punished for expressing them. So, knowing that she truly believes in what she says, she's not saying anything to hurt people, but of course she sent that book to the school, so she has to be punished, and so she got her punishment, which she knew she would, and she did it anyway. And you have to give her a very nice round of applause. And if I could, I'd like to show you a picture of her, but I'm not going to use her picture this time on the program page, but it's a wonderful picture. So in a little time and before we take our break, I want to bring to your attention something about Elie Wiesel, because I hope all of you listeners are keeping up with my Elie Wiesel Cons of World website. I've sent a letter to the Boston University president, Robert Wood. That's where Elie is employed as a high-level professorship, where he's kind of kept by them. And we have some activity going on about this letter, but I'm waiting to post it on my website until we can send out a further letter, which is being held up because of some technical internet program difficulties or hang-ups. So I'm not going to say any more about that right now, but keep tuned into that, please. Now, a little bit of news on Elie Wiesel that I just picked up. He's going to deliver a lecture at Wesleyan University titled Building an Ethical Society, the Death Penalty and Human Dignity. Well, now he's coming out against the death penalty, you know, to try to make himself appear ethical. But he's going to be speaking on this on October 26th in Memorial Chapel at this Wesleyan University. And I'm sorry, I don't have here, they're not saying where this school is, but I'll tell you later. The thing that's interesting about this is that the arrangements for Elie Wiesel were made through B'nai B'rith Lecture Bureau. Oh. Yes, well, they make sure. This is B'nai B'rith. They might as well be the Israeli Mossad. This is the worldwide Jewish network which promotes everything to do with Holocaust lies. And, of course, they promote Elie Wiesel and try to keep up. That's how did he get the United States Congressional Gold Medal through all their efforts, and the Medal of Liberty Award through all of their efforts, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom through all of their efforts. Now, here's some more. He's got the rank of Grand Croix in the French Legion of Honor, and he's got an honorary knighthood of the British Empire, and which was awarded by Her Majesty the Queen, and he's got, of course, the Nobel Peace Prize. So he has received more than 120 honorary degrees. How did he get all these degrees? What did he do? Of course, it's the work of the industry. It's the work of the Jewish International Network, and B'nai B'rith Lecture Bureau is a part of that. So he's going to now, you know, and you can believe that he's going to have tremendous security. It says that the lecture is free, but the tickets are hard to get. No doubt. Anyway, it's going to be at 7 p.m. on October 26th, and I will have more information about that later. We haven't had a lecture, a public exposure of Ellie recently, but I doubt he's going to be exposed to the public here either, because they will just whisk him in a secret way, and he will be on the podium there. He'll give his speech, and then he'll whisk him out so that there cannot be any demonstrations taking place. But we'll see. When I come back, I'm going to spend the rest of the program talking about the Demjanjuk trial and Sobibor. So see you on the other side.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
I'm talking to Roger Helmer, who's a Eurosceptic member of the European Parliament. He's vehemently opposed to further integration with the European Union and also supports renegotiating many of the UK's treaties with the EU. Roger Helmer, thank you very much for talking to RT. First of all, how would you characterise the UK's relationship with the EU?
There's a big question. We have always been reluctant members of the European Union. When we joined it, we were told that it was merely a trading operation. We had a referendum. I voted in favour. If I'd known then what I know now, I would have voted against. But we have this unfortunate feeling that on the one hand, we don't like it very much. We resent all the nonsense. On the other hand, many people think, well, Europe's a long way away. It doesn't affect me very much, so let them get on with it. In fact, of course, it does intimately affect the lives of all of us, and huge swathes of policy areas are decided in Brussels, not decided in the UK. In my view, it is making us poorer and less democratic and less free, and I believe we would be better off out.
Do you support, at this stage, a referendum on being in the EU, if it were possible?
Well, I think we should start with the referendum that every major political party in Britain promised us, which is the referendum on the Lisbon Treaty. What they're now saying is, well, it's been ratified, it's too late. No, it isn't too late. We should have a referendum saying, do you accept the terms of the Lisbon Treaty, or do you wish the government to renegotiate those terms? And that would give, I'm sure we get a renegotiation answer, that would give a British government a very strong position, a very strong mandate to renegotiate. So that's what we ought to do. Now, the question that is also arising, should we have a referendum on in or out? I'm less clear there what the outcome would be. I think probably after a good campaign we would actually get an out vote, but I'm less confident of it. And of course if we had an in or out vote and the people voted to stay in, then I suppose the issue would be off the agenda for 20 years. So from my point of view that is a high risk route. I would just like to see the referendum that we originally were promised.
It always interests me to meet members of the European Parliament who are opposed to the EU as a construct. How does that work?
Well, I'm often asked that question, and there's a sort of underlying assumption that if you take the Brussels shilling, then you're there to support them. And sadly, that applies to too many people. It applies to the great majority of MEPs and virtually all the staff, virtually all the commissioners, and so on. I take the view that I'm not elected to support the European Union and to promote it. I'm elected to represent the interests of the people who voted for me. And I recall that in the last election in 2009, a majority of voters in my region, and nationally I think, supported broadly Eurosceptic parties, or at least they believed that the Conservative Party was Eurosceptic, which brings us to the issue that in terms of the coalition government, it's really failing to deliver on that expectation.
Prime Minister David Cameron's position as a Eurosceptic didn't seem to be in any doubt before he came to power, but now it doesn't seem to be so clear.
I think it's tragic. Something that my colleague Dan Hannan points out is that the higher people climb up the greasy pole, the more sympathetic they become to large centres of power like the European Union. You take William Hague, he had a reputation as a clear, principled Eurosceptic. I had great confidence in him. It seems to me now that he's shifted his position, he's trimmed so that he's sort of prepared to accommodate. He's prepared to come up with a few Eurosceptic quotes from time to time, but actually we've accepted regular EU regulation of the City of London, we've accepted the EU diplomatic service.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I now am going to turn our attention to another revisionist Holocaust trial. This is not a revisionist trial, but a trial against someone who has offended the Holocaust industry. And this is the very well-known John Demjanjuk case. And the reason I want to talk about this today is more to talk about the new book, Sobibor, which has come out and is being promoted by three of our bookstores. And one of them is new, and the first two are Thesis and Dissertations Press, which is run by Michael Santomaro and used to belong to Guillermo Rudolph. And they have the book, and they have all of those books that Guillermo Rudolph published when he was in charge of Thesis and Dissertation Press. But now that the Barnes Review has gotten the entire stock of these Holocaust books by Guillermo Rudolph, that he published, not just written by him, but published by him. And they're called the Holocaust Handbook Series. And they now carry all of those, and you can order them. And they have a new book. They have a new website. Their website is revamped, and you go there to www.barnesreview.org, and you find all the books and magazines that you can order, all very well organized. And they now carry the entire Holocaust Handbook Series. And the new book, Sobibor, which is by the great revisionist writers Jürgen Graf, Carlo Mattogno, and Thomas Kues, is available and has been for, maybe almost a month now. And they're also carrying Carlo Mattogno's brand new book in English. It's been out in other languages already for a while, but it just now came out in English, and that is his two-volume book, Auschwitz, A Case for Sanity. And that has all the latest about Auschwitz by Carlo, who is quite the expert on Auschwitz. That's his specialty. And Thomas Kues is a Swedish researcher who has joined these two in writing Sobibor, because he's done quite a bit of work on Sobibor, and he's done a lot of excellent writing himself. So I just ordered these two books myself, but I have not read them yet. But Jürgen Graf sent me a summary of the book Sobibor, and that's what I'm going by in talking to you about it. And I will be reading it. Now, the other bookstore that I didn't mention yet, because I want to make a special case of it, is the Coda bookstore. Codo, C-O-D-O-H, you know, Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. Bradley Smith's group, and they have just opened a bookstore online. And if you go to www.codo.com, you'll find it advertised, and you can go to the bookstore and you see what they have. They are building up their stock, but they are carrying also the entire collection of these Holocaust Handbook Series, and these books are available there too. In fact, that's where I bought mine, because they're new and they need some business too. And they need some encouragement. So on to the trial. As I don't want to forget, before I start, that Jürgen writes that they are also planning to write, the three of them are going to write another book about the Einsatzgruppen question, which thrills me because this is where we really need to put our attention. And as he says, this is the last big problem of the, quote, Holocaust, unquote, that complex that the revisionists have never systematically dealt with. And they are going to do that in this book. And he says that they have all the Einsatzgruppen reports on microfilm, which constitutes many thousands of pages, but they lack the necessary funds to make them computer compatible. So they're needing donations, and they're asking for financial support, and I hope that can be put out through various vehicles. And now back to the book Sobibor. You know, we have to go all the way back to when Jimmy Carter was president. And Jürgen says that Jimmy Carter bears the responsibility for the political decision, which had dreadful consequences for many innocent people. And this was in the 1979 establishment of the Office of Special Investigations. This came about because of a request by Elizabeth Holtzman, a Jewish congresswoman, who not only a request, but no doubt many requests, and she really pushed and pushed this through. And this task force became a special office within the U.S. Ministry of Justice, and its whole purpose is the detection of Nazi war criminals on American soil. Now, this is wrong to begin with, because what do Americans have to do with Nazi war criminals? You know, this is not the job of Americans or the American government. But according to the Jewish network that I was complaining about earlier in the first segment of the program, they are busy making that everybody's business, and everybody's spending their money on doing this in their interest. So he says that, you know, this agency has focused on revoking the U.S. citizenship of immigrants of German and East European descent for alleged Nazi war crimes, even though these crimes are more often than not just invented. But all that the United States is asked to do is to revoke the citizenship of these people and deport them back to the country they came from. And of course, once they are deported back or extradited back, they're not U.S. citizens anymore, then those countries can prosecute them, and they do. And he points out that the OSI is headed by, since 1995, and this has to be current, it's headed by Eli Rosenbaum of Jewish faith, and the deputy head is Ronnie L. Edelman of Jewish faith. Rosenbaum's predecessor was Neil Scheer, likewise a Jew, and the OSI chief investigator was Edward Stutman, also a Jew, who died, though, in 2005. But he is the one who managed to have John Demjanjuk, an American citizen of Ukrainian descent, stripped of his U.S. citizenship, and because he supposedly committed atrocities at the Sobibor camp in East Poland during the Second World War. Of course, he didn't commit any atrocities. And according to John Demjanjuk, who is now 89 years old, he wasn't even at Sobibor. But he denies that he was ever there. He was a guard somewhere else, but not at Sobibor. And he is the one, of course, I don't want to go back into this, but he was charged with being Ivan the Terrible. He spent 7 years, 5 years in a solitary death row in Israel because of these lying witnesses who accused him of all kinds of things. And then they found out that, they were mistaken, and you know, he wasn't Ivan the Terrible. Somebody else was. And, you know, so he's released and sent home. Wonderful. And he's given, you know, the United States gives him his citizenship back. But what about these lying witnesses? What's done about them? Nothing. They deprived this man of all these years of his life, put him through hell, but nothing happens to them. Okay. The thing is that the main basis of this charge against John Demjanjuk is that they have an identity card with his picture on it that shows that he was a guard at Sobibor in 1943. But in 1987, there was an expert on forgeries and cards like this named Dieter Lehner, who concluded that this identity card was a crude forgery. Not only a forgery, but a crude forgery. And even Der Spiegel magazine said in 1993 the document had obviously been forged. But now it's back in business again. They're using it. And they have some witnesses or people who say they know something about it. And they're accusing him of the murder. He's being held guilty of the murder of 29,000 prisoners at that camp because they say that he is the one who led them into the gas chambers. And therefore they died, so he's responsible for their deaths. Although Graf says that the court was unable to muster even a single witness claiming to have seen Demjanjuk at Sobibor. You know, they don't have witnesses, but they have something. They have what they think is enough. Here's the story. According to the Holocaust historians, this is the establishment, Sobibor was a pure extermination camp. And this is one of the Reinhard camps. This is the camps that are in eastern Poland that are considered death camps that were, and they all have the same, pretty much the same story. But they are listed by the Germans as being places where they were deporting all these Jews to the east Germany was still in control of a lot of territory of the Soviet Union from the 1941 invasion. And so they were moving these Jews into that area where that they still controlled from Poland, because they wanted to deport all these Jews far into the east so they wouldn't come back, I guess, into the west. But in the establishment literature, Sobibor is portrayed as a death camp, and here's how it's portrayed. They were Jews were brought on trains, and there was a reception area once they got there, and this reception area was known as Camp 2. And they dropped them off. They took them into the reception area, and they robbed them of everything, and all their clothes too. And then they were marched naked to the extermination area, which was Camp 3. It's like as soon as they got there, these people were killed. That's the idea. They took out a few people, a few able-bodied men, to work at doing all that work. Taking these people, you know, meeting the people at the train, taking them to the extermination center, putting them in the gas chambers, hauling out the corpses, burying the corpses, and then we'll go into that later, how they dug them up supposedly. But so here you have this crazy story that you have these Jews coming, and then they pick out a few, and they're doing all this work of killing all these Jews and burying them. And supposedly this took place between 1942 May and October 1943, which is a year and a half. Now, 250,000 Jews, they say. They seem to think that these were all Jews who were taken. These were all Jews that were taken to these camps, because these were Jews that were being deported. That could be true. 250,000 Jews from various European countries were allegedly gassed at Sobibor. Well, a large number of Jews were taken to those camps and deported further east. But it says that until October 1943, the corpses of the victims were buried in large trenches. But in October 1943, the Germans switched from burial to cremation. Well, of course, because there's no bodies to be found there. So they had to come up with this story that now these poor workers who were doing this for no other reason, knowing they were going to be killed themselves, but they, you know, got a little better food, were now had to do all this work of digging up all these corpses, 250,000 of them, friends, and burning them on some pyres that they had built. And they were busy doing this, you know. Can you imagine? And at the same time, new arrivals were coming, and they weren't buried. They were cremated right away on these pyres after being gassed in the gas chamber. Okay, so It's known, it's stated that no crematorium existed at Sobibor, only the gas chamber, so therefore all the burning had to be done outdoors on pyres. And they said that the ashes and the human remains were thrown into the now empty mass graves. Well, if all those ashes and human remains were thrown in there, and if they're burning on pyres, they would have a lot of human remains, like a lot of bones and stuff that didn't burn, would be down in those mass graves, and they would be able to find it. But we're going to see that as time went on, they didn't find anything there. So then another fantasy is that on 14th October 1943, this is again in October when everything seemed to stop there, a revolt broke out by these workers. They finally decided to revolt after a year and a half. And they killed several SS men and some non-German guards, and hundreds of Jewish prisoners escaped, they say. And that's how you have all these witnesses saying what happened there. And soon after, the camp closed down. So they take credit for closing the camp down, but that's really not the way it went. Now, this is the official version, but Jürgen Graf says that it's all based on eyewitness testimony and the confessions of the perpetrators. And the German wartime documents are very rare, and they do not corroborate the Orthodox version in any way. In any way. Now, this is what he says. This is what you're going to find in the book. That in spite of what the Orthodox historians say, and these people are not historians, when we talk about Holocaust historians, very few, maybe very, very few, are actually trained historians. But then the revisionists, very few are trained historians either. Most people writing pro and on both sides of the Holocaust issue are writers, people who, well-educated people, but people who got very interested in this subject and studied it and then decided to write something about it. But they're not, historians stay away from it. Trained historians stay away from it because they're supposed to look for the truth. And they know that if they tell the truth about the Holocaust, they'll lose everything. So they don't even go there. They stay away from it. Alright, the wartime documents, there are German wartime documents, but they don't corroborate this version that I just told you about. And in fact, some of them, three of them, explicitly call Sobibor a transit camp. Now the book, I'm going to go through the chapters in the time that I have left. I might not get through all of them, but chapter one is the introduction, and that's where they talk about the Demjanjuk trial and their decision to write the book. And chapter two talks about the existing literature about Sobibor, which is, as I said, about 18 books and articles, and demonstrates that the evidence for homicidal gassings at Sobibor was actually fabricated by the German judiciary long after the war. By the German judiciary. You know, that's that German judiciary is about as bad as anything you can find anywhere. In chapter 3, Carlo Mattonio demonstrates that the earliest tales which witnesses spoke about were things like the killings by chlorine and some kind of a black fluid, really wild stories. And that's where that story about the collapsible floor in the death chambers came, you know, where they, once the people were all dead, the floor collapsed and all the dead people fell underneath. And then they carted them all out up to the ground level to take them to the burial spot. Now, why would you drop them down underground and then have to drag them back up again? But that's... Anyway, so because all of this was so unbelievable, the actual version that they go with today was invented by a Polish war crimes commission in 1947. And it wasn't even based on any of the eyewitnesses of Sobibor. It was based on a report on Belzec. So what they follow about what happened at Belzec by this fellow named Gerstein, that's what they use for Sobibor too. So and that way they would be consistent, which helps them, I'm sure. In chapter 4, we're dealing with examples by Thomas Kues of witnesses, showing that there's not a single credible witness telling a lot of these tales that they told. One example here is that Several witnesses claim that Sector 3 was so perfectly camouflaged that the Jews working in other sectors, Camps 1 and 2, did not realize for weeks or even for months that they were in an extermination camp. And other witnesses say an exact opposite of this, that there was a horrible stench, flames from the pyres were visible everywhere, screams of the dying Jews in the gas chambers could be heard, you know, all around the camp. I mean, those are two totally opposing, and this is what we find in the Holocaust. Wherever you look, we find completely opposite, contradictory testimonies. And what do they do about it? They just ignore it. They don't care. They say, well, people remember things differently. People don't remember exactly right, but they have enough of the truth in it to make their make them a good witness. You know, this is typical. In chapter 5, which Jurgen says is the most important chapter in the whole book, in his opinion, Thomas Cuse presents an analysis of the evidence for Sobibor that the establishment gives and the quality of it. And he says, in the year 2000, an establishment team, an archaeology team, which is headed by Andrzej Kola, a Pole, a professor of archaeology at the University of Torun in Poland, and all of his crew, were composing of whatever, they went to Sobibor and made soundings and diggings on the grounds. This information has not been in English yet. It's newly accessible in English in this new book, Sobibor, for the first time. And he says, what he found was that the gassing building, which they've been talking about all these years, that there was no such building. And if there was no such building, there could be no gassings. Now, why there is no such buildings is that the building that supposedly all these witnesses, or the some of them, there are not that many, but the witnesses that said that the gassing building was a concrete building and it was a such and such size. But instead, what this Kola team found, they found a T-shaped building, which is 6 meters by 60 meters, three times longer than the supposed gas chamber that these witnesses had described. And it was made of wood. It had been made of wood when it was there. This is just remains. It had been made of wood, not concrete. And what they found in that area there, in the ground, they found cones, mirrors, hair clips, etc., things like this. So this is not what you would find at a in a gas chamber. This would find where people were changing their clothes and getting deloused and redressing to go on their journey. And supposedly that when the victims came into that part of the camp, this is Camp 3, they were completely naked. Everything had been taken away from them. So, after Kola, they sent a second team of archaeologists, two Israelis and a Pole, and they continued to search for this gassing building that had been described by these witnesses, but they didn't find it. And so, what we're left with is Thomas Cuse convincingly argues in this chapter that probably no more than a few thousand corpses were buried at this place where they had the burial mounds. And that... naturally, all these people were deported, you know, 150,000 or so, up to 250,000. But it's probably the number of deportees is probably more like 150,000 to 170,000. And some of them would have died on the way in the trains. Some would have, you know, a lot of these people were elderly. And some of them would have died from diseases. And some of them would have been executed by things that they had done, or they had still executed partisans that they might have found around that area, you know, in that neighborhood. And so naturally there were deaths, but so Thomas Cuse puts the total of deaths at Sobibor at about 10,000 Jews at the most. Now, you know, they're always making generous estimates, 10,000, and as to against 250,000 that the establishment Holocaust story says. So I'm going to have to stop with this, and on another program I'm going to continue with the rest of the chapters in this book and say a little bit more about some of these Holocaust handbook series. I want to thank you all for listening. I hope this has been instructive. And tune in again next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.